If you ever wanted to know how your ovaries affect your training, what ISA is best for your retirement, or which protein powder will cause diarrhea, then look no further. Welcome to the I Cannot Believe It podcast. We'll discuss everything you need to know with practical advice and instant application to your life with experts across every industry in the Royal Borough. I'm Greg Mikolab and I run Icon Gym, but we don't just talk fitness. In fact, we talk very little about fitness because we talk a lot about it in the gym. Our members, though, are people first and foremost. They have their questions, worries, and plans. So in this podcast, I will be dispelling common myths, worries, and things that everyone should know, but few do, by collaborating with local experts. We'll talk about recycling, mortgages, planning for retirement or holiday, and periods. Stay tuned if you want to know more about helpful stuff in life.
A proper scratch, I can hear it.
Hear it
probably, yeah.
Yeah.
Chris, so everything seems to be working now.
Good.
We started talking, what do you do?
Yeah.
And then I haven't pressed the record button, so I'm pressing record button. So Chris, obviously in the I Cannot Believe It podcast, we'll be talking about workplace and efficient working and attention span, and I guess wherever this conversation will lead to, I guess you have an agenda. I see you have notes. And members who are quite excited as well, because they are mainly professionals here. But so what do you do and why are you fascinated by the way people work? I guess that's the...
Yeah, it's a weird one how I fell into it. I guess like anyone falls into anything. So I started off working for professional bodies, which are the companies that you tend to see on the certificates for qualifications. So it might be the Association of Woodcutters, if you're into woodcutting, or HR professionals or accountancy.
So I worked, okay, like an NVQ kind of.
That's it. Yeah, but it's more about the professional bodies that set the standards for the skills that you have to learn to be able to do that job. So I spent my time at the Institute of Marketing. So I did a lot of stuff in marketing and all the rest of it. But I ended up at the Institute of Facilities Management. And it's a profession I'd never heard of, facilities management. But these are basically the people that manage buildings for companies. So any office block will have a facilities manager.
Yes.
And I didn't understand it. But there was a movement within that group of professionals saying we need to become more modern, more contemporary. And what they came up with and what they clung to was this idea of workplace management. And that was the idea that there's a reason we have these buildings. There's a reason that we have people that look after these buildings, is to make amazing workplaces so that people can have amazing experiences and therefore do really good work. And that was, I kind of got into that in 2014. And then since then, I've been in and around different roles where we've looked at the changing nature of working environments and how they impact people's work. And that kind of takes you into ideas about culture and ways of working and behaviors in organizations.
Sounds like a Pandora's box.
It was a little bit, because you start looking underneath like rocks, you start finding all this different stuff. So what I do today, I've got a podcast myself called The Workplace Geeks, and that looks at academics that are doing research into different parts of that workplace experience. So that might be psychology, sociology, it might be space design, it could be anything that's related to how and where and what we do in our work. And I've just launched a new software business which measures workplace experience and uses written employee feedback to help organizations improve workplace experience. So that's how I kind of got into it and what I do now.
So we plug in straight away.
Absolutely.
Podcast and the business. Okay, cool. Now for the value. Why on the base of your podcast, before we move on, just why did you go from an academic point of view, which is I don't know, I guess with the workplace and the quality of the workplace, what goes to it is the attention. I think we had a chat when we first met about it. And I always think the way, if you get scientists or educators, you know, formal educators to speak, sometimes it might be that it's hard to get people's attention on such topics because they can be quite in-depth or serious. So why going this route rather than a soundbite?
Well, it was almost exactly for that reason. So I was looking at leaving my role at the Institute for Workplace and Facilities Management. I was leaving, but I didn't want to leave the community. I didn't want to leave the sector. So I was looking for reasons and ways of staying in the conversation, but not necessarily having a role anymore that I could hang my hat on.
Okay.
And at the same time, I was studying for an MBA. And what I found with the MBA is that there was a lot of stuff and ideas that I'd heard about. Maslow's hierarchy of needs. And yeah, I did pass the MBA, by the way, just in case me forgetting everything and having to recall it. But Maslow's hierarchy of needs is something that a lot of people that goes to any conference will see up on the screen. But what was interesting about the MBA is you start looking at the academic articles and journals and research papers, and you realize that there's this massive body of knowledge that exists. But like you say, we don't see it because typically these reports are boring for the average reader because they're written in a very specific style. If they want to be printed in a journal, they've got to structure it in a very specific way. They've got to reference it in a very specific way. They've got to use language in a very specific way. So what we wanted to do with the podcast is say, look, there's so many interesting things that go on that, studying workplaces and why they work and why they might not work. But let's, rather than asking academics just to publish papers, let's get them onto the show. Let's talk to them. And we talk to them about what they found, because that's what people want to know about. But we also talk to them about, why did you measure it that way? Why did you set the study up in that way? What were the ethical problems with studying it? We spoke to someone who were strapping Fitbits to people, and that brings in medical data, and then there's ethics that sit with that. So how did they get around that? So we look at the research method as much as we look at the research output. So that was, and also there's lots of podcasts about work because it's something that everybody does, and they tend to be quite general. They can tend to be an author's thought this. And we have interviewed some authors, sort of general authors. But we just felt that there's a scientific community that didn't have a voice. But the guy that co-hosted it with me comes from an academic background. So it was a really nice
kind of partnership. And I guess people do like scientific podcasts or audiobooks because they enjoy when the concepts, complicated concepts, are presented in more digestible way. And I guess that means that as well, when you invite someone, the level of understanding of that person is quite high if they can explain it to yourself or me, right? Without taking anything. I don't have an MBA, you have an MBA, but let's say if they can explain it to me, that means they really know the topic because I know nothing about it, right? Yeah. And because I run a gym, you basically know I don't do any academic stuff.
But it's important though, because there's academic methods and practice, right? But there's knowledge. And knowledge shouldn't be locked up in academia, right? Knowledge is generated there. But it shouldn't be locked up there. It should be able to come through. Now, I don't come from a family that had, I didn't go to university. My parents didn't go to university. So we're not come from it's not an academic family or environment that I've ever come from. But I've always worked on the principle of pub English. You know, can I, if I was in a pub explaining something to somebody who might be, and this isn't getting sort of snooty about different professions, but let's say you're a plumber and plumbers know a lot more about central heating systems than I do. I wouldn't ever dare to do it myself, right? So there's specialisms of knowledge. But they're not exposed to business ideas and big academic studies about the way culture works in organizations and stuff like that. So you've got to find a way of being able to talk to them that they can relate to and that they can digest, regardless of what their background is or what their, education level is or whatever their academic background, whatever it might be. We've got to find a kind of common language so we can talk about these things. So the way it works on the podcast is that Ian, who's a former lecturer at university and all the rest of it, he really dives into the study. He really explores the different parts of it. But he's also a teacher, so he can help make it digestible and not get too cloaked up, right? And he'll listen to this podcast. So I'm giving away a bit of a secret here, but he does lots of preparation for the interviews. I'll read the notes about an hour before I interview the person. And that means I know generally what we're talking about, but it also allows me to ask the questions that someone outside of this world might ask in a way that they might ask it. So I ask essentially stupid questions, but they're the obvious questions for someone who isn't living and breathing this every day.
Exactly. And it's and I guess if someone lives and breathes every day, so like from fitness, you know, perspective, we have to remind ourselves as coaches, because we get the same questions every day.
Yeah.
You just think, okay. So we have obviously videos on it, we have like something we can reference.
Yeah.
But yeah, you do lose perspective of what people actually need. So on that note, was the last 2-3 years since the lockdown started the sort of most tumultuous period of work life or balance or work experience for you in your opinion?
What, in terms of my personal work and or experience, like, or just
your
topic?
Work, the work you do?
Yeah, I definitely think so. But I think it's almost like, imagine you were doing something for years and years and years and years, and then suddenly the world really cared about it, whereas before then they didn't, and they didn't ask you a lot. So let's say, for instance, you've been a gym instructor for 20 years, but no one liked going to gyms, and then suddenly everyone did. So there's this sort of moment where you have this loads of attention, which you're thinking, oh, finally, great, this is really interesting. We've got this opportunity now to talk about the way we work and how we work and what we do with work.
Mm-hmm.
But it also brings with it kind of people that want to pass comment that aren't as informed as you would like. So like the national headlines that were coming out about hybrid work, about home working versus office working, the whole community just felt that it was kind of missing the point. Because it became about you either work from home or work from the office, and
so it's more of an opinion piece rather than actual informed. Yeah. This is the expert. That's what sort of science says. That's what research tends us to believe.
And I guess it's fair enough because when you spend I've come into this community. It's getting on for 8-9 years. Okay, so I've been in it. The idea of how people work and where they work has evolved from sort of the early 70s, where the professions that look after it really started to appear, and organizations, it was based kind of on the personal computer, started arriving, and we started designing offices and stuff like that. So they've got this sort of decades and decades of experience and knowledge and viewpoint that's been iteratively built from the last generation. But then suddenly everyone comes into the party and everyone's got an opinion on it. So it's been a sort of a weird period where it's exciting that everyone's having that conversation, but equally it can be a little bit frustrating because it feels, for those that have been closest to it, we've had to go back a few steps to go, okay, right, let's look at it slightly differently.
So I guess the biggest change now and the word that we use is the hybrid, right?
Yeah.
So hybrid work, in my understanding, is that you work some days from home, some days from the office. Is that hybrid work?
So I've never been a big fan of hybrid as a term throughout this whole period. It's not something that I think, that I think is helpful, because it suggests that there's two options, but the reality is there's lots of different options, right? So it could be home, could be office, it could be cafe, it could be a co-working space, it could be lots of different places. Now, I think the problem with the word hybrid is that it's being used as a location description. So, take what you said there. You said that you either do it at home or you do it in the office. Now, what people are starting to say is actually hybrid is useful, but talk about it as in a sort of duality of experience. So you might have a hybrid meeting where you've got some people physically in the room and some people digitally in the room. They could be anywhere.
Okay.
So working environments have now got to manage this idea that not everyone is going to be in the same place at the same time. And that's the way to think about it. And that's been the biggest change throughout this whole period. Now, the argument for something like hybrid is that it gives people a word to describe something that's a bit more nebulous. So we now have a situation where employees can have conversations with their employers about working in a different way to the 9-to-5 Monday to Friday. And if it helps them to say, I want to work in a hybrid way, it acts as a kind of a general term for, I'm not going to be here every day because I'm going to I've got stuff in my life, I've got responsibilities, I've got stuff going on or ways that I want to work that don't look like they did pre-pandemic. So there's pluses and minuses for it, but that was kind of the word. It kind of felt like it was coined by the media because they needed something to call it, and you know, that comes with its challenges.
Okay, so it can mean many things.
Yeah.
And people confused, basically. Like, I confused, just asking you that. I just confused the meaning of the hybrid. So, and would you say that... So, did you say you're not a fan of hybrid as a work sort of culture, or you're not a fan of the hybrid used as just as a location? Yeah. Is that what you meant?
I'm a big fan of the idea, massive fan of the idea in its broadest term. I just think it's dangerous using it the way that the media used it for a long time as a kind of binary if or choice between home and office.
Yeah, I mean, and even I think they use it now because even there was a news a few weeks ago about certain companies, you know, big companies in London deciding that the work will move hybrid, therefore employees have to be only in the office for 2 or 3 days. Yeah, yeah. Which with the assumption then the remaining days are done at home, right? Not at different location.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was, so hybrid is, I think, very much in my head as someone who, you know, works in a gym. So the option is I have to be here in person.
Yeah.
Is that is very much location based. And what you're saying is that basically it means that I will not be in the office. It doesn't mean that I will be at home, right? Yeah, yeah. It doesn't mean that I'm building a little sort of shed at the end of my garden to work from there. It doesn't mean that at all. It just means that I will not be physically present in the room.
Well, it could mean, I mean, this is the thing about it. It could mean that. It could mean something different. You know, I think I think for me, and this is why the term hybrid, I mean, technically means the combination of two things, right? If you think about hybrid cars, it's about two power sources. We interviewed a professor, Susan Halford, on, I think it was like the fifth episode of our podcast. And she wrote a paper in 2005 about hybrid working, right?
Oh, wow.
And I sort of put the question to her. I said, did you kind of invent the term? And she said, well, I didn't see anyone else using it. So I guess I did, right?
Spoke to a pioneer.
Exactly. So this is, you know, we're talking 15 years before the pandemic even arrived. And also, I mean, that was when it was published. She did the study in 2003, I think. So what she talked about, though, is that true hybridity, which was a word I couldn't even get my mouth around when she said it, so I've had to practice
hybridity.
It. Hybridity. She said, think about it in biological terms, right? So if you have a hybrid rose, for instance, you might breed a red rose and a white rose together. You'll get a pink rose. You won't get a red and white rose. You'll get a pink rose. You get something different, not two versions, you know, like a half and half split of whatever.
Okay,
it is.
Kind of like blue, yellow, you get a green one,
yeah,
right?
Exactly. So think about it. I mean, there is a bit of marriage advice that says that two single people become something different when they become a couple, right? So that's the kind of idea with hybrid, to think about meshing all these experiences together. And that, you know, there's a guy called Neil Asher, and I'm hopefully not misquoting him, but he's quite a prominent figure in workplace thinking. And he talks about work being hybrid, not locations. So how we work and what we do can have different modes and different forms and different ways of doing it.
And okay, and this is what's the end goal? Is it the end goal to have happier people working, or is like, what's the goal of, why are we even interested in the topic?
Well, I think there's several reasons why it became interesting, right? Now, remote working, which is what really this is, right? This is the idea that you can work here or you can work there, right? So there's remote working. Now, that's something that's been technically possible. Again, another podcasting guest of ours was a NASA scientist in 1975 who wrote a paper demonstrating how technically we could do remote working, right? And the reason he was into remote working was because he wanted to reduce traffic jams. That was all about everyone traveling into the city and traveling out again. So we've been talking about remote working for a very, very, very long time. The reason remote working has never worked is because culturally, and really what we're talking about is management style, hasn't lent itself to people working where I can't see them, right? So it's classic, what, you know, presenteeism. I need to know where my people are so that I can make sure they're doing their work. And we've never really shaken that. Now, what the pandemic did was force that situation, right? No one in most industries, most sectors, most organizations would voluntarily have said, yes, we're going to send everyone home to work from there for any period of time to see if it works.
Well, like a massive experiment. And yeah. I think, so I know a lot of anecdotes.
Yeah.
From speaking to people.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know. I haven't read a single study on working. I read a lot of studies on training people. And I know why it's important to talk about it. That's why I ask why it's important about workplace. But from the things I heard,
yeah,
most of the companies made the same amount of money.
Yeah.
Even though they had a, you know, period of a bit of a downturn.
Yeah.
They ended up okay.
Yeah.
If not better.
Mm-hmm.
They reduced the expenses.
Yeah.
Which probably contributed to making more money as well. Yeah. One of public companies, one of the sort of C-suite person from the public company told me that normally at their year end, the CEO travels to all the different locations and it's like the most knackering week of that person's life.
Yeah, yeah.
Every quarter or like every year. And they didn't have to do it. They logged into a few Zoom calls. They're like, look, I can be at any time of the day available because I need to speak with Singapore, then I need to speak with US.
Yeah.
But they did it from the comfort of their own home.
Yeah.
And they loved it.
Yeah.
And they're like, what was the point of so many first class tickets or of how much money we've spent as a company before? On the other hand, a lot of guys that I know, they were on the in a sales division. What they missed, I guess. They say when you go in sale, right, you're going to have a chat. You're going to have a conversation like we have a conversation. Yeah. And within that conversation, we talk about something, but then other things come up and I will pick up on them. You know, I will see that you, for example, scratching your lower back. I will ask you about maybe you had any injuries and I will say, come on, sign up. I will fix that for you, right? Yeah. And they said they missed that. They missed that sort of just a casual conversation that leads to a sale that because they said when they had a schedule call on Zoom, someone logged in, they just wanted to hear the, you know, information as is, and logged out, so they had to like try things like I will log in 5 minutes before for an off chance that that person logs in earlier so we can have a bit of a chat. And something that I want to ask you as well later on about the desensitization of humans towards each other because of the screen. Because of the I read the conclusion of a study. I remember a study, but the how close you see someone's face on a video call, in a normal sort of situation, that would be a situation where you either punch them or you kiss them, right? It's kind of like it's so close, so intimate that it's either there is an aggressive move being made towards me, my life is in danger, or we're gonna be sexual mates, right? And
either way, your heart rate's going to go up.
The heart rate's going to go up. And because you have those calls, right?
Yeah.
That desensitizes you to then, like, when you see a person, do you actually see the person in front of you? All the emotions, all the body language, mimicry, and all these things. So I guess I'm jumping the gun here a lot. But is there a... Obviously, I will get people to listen to your podcast, which is Workplace Geeks. But is there an optimum way, as you know, of setting up a mixed work that will work for the person and also for the company? Or what's sort of been...
Yeah, I mean, everyone's desperate for that formula, right? Everyone's desperate for it. Companies are desperate for it because one of the problems they've got... So, you know, there's a lot that you covered there, right? But let's work through it. So we had the great experiment. So you're right. Organizations were worried. You know, they were terrified that they're going to send everyone home and they were going to look at all their productivity, performance, whatever numbers they care about, and they're all going to tank. And there was a little blip, but that was a blip because everyone in the world was too busy thinking about how they get through the next few months, not what they're going to buy and what they're going to purchase, right? So that was challenge number one. But they sort of went, oh, hold on a minute. It's not as bad as we thought. right? And then, like you say, your chief exec example, they're going, well, actually, I don't need to do all that traveling. I can have, okay, maybe it's not as effective as being in the room with people, but what's the net effect of me not having to be in all these different places and not being with my family for a week and, you know, burning the candle at both ends and being, you know, knackered and not being able to do my other bits and bobs, you know? So there was, what we found is that there's this sort of realization from both organizations that, this isn't as bad as I thought. Also, turns out we had more office space than we needed. So they started reducing the size and costs, right? And that was happening before COVID,
was it?
Right? Okay. Yeah. I mean, it was really funny. Like when you see these big banking firms come out and say, we're going to reduce our estate by 40%. You can't just make that decision overnight, right? You can't just do it within the time frame
especially
of a pandemic.
Especially not how leases are signed,
exactly,
right? Not
right.
How these decisions at that level are made.
They're massive, massive deals. So they would have been talking about that for a long time. What the pandemic gave them was a kind of post-rational reason to say, well, you know, look, this is kind of worked out because it turns out we don't need it because, you know, we're going to work in this way. So organizations are like, this is all right. And then you got individuals saying, hold on a minute. It means I can drop the kids off at school and I don't ever get to do that. And that's nice. And then I can come back and do some work or I need something delivered. So it broke down a lot of preconceived ideas from organizations that were worried about letting people off the leash. And it also broke a lot of stigmas about homework and being like, you know, sort of sloping off and not working hard enough because you're just, you know, watching daytime TV because people work bloody hard during the pandemic, right? But what we're also finding, and this is where the you know, my challenge with the hybrid kind of comes in again, which is it's all or nothing. Like there was sort of this moment in the conversation where it's like, we're all going to work from home or we're all going to work from the office. It's like, well, and also we're not all going to work in the same way, right? So take administrative tasks. Let's say you're a bookkeeper for a company, right? You might, pre-pandemic, have gone into the office and spoke to nobody because your job is just to process forms and expenses and receipts. And you only need to send the odd message to someone saying, have you got the receipt for this, right? You don't actually need that communication and human touch, right? So why have I got to travel an hour on the tube? Why have I got to do that? Why have I got to put a load of pollution in the air to get there, right? Now, if that person's lonely at home, let's say they live alone and that's their only interaction and they want that, then great, come on in. That's a good reason to come in. But if your life is great and you're happy with your community and you don't need to come in, then don't come in. But if you're a salesperson that buzzes off that energy, then do come in. And then it's up to organizations to truly understand their employees and the work that they do to go, this is how we're going to shape the workplace experience. Now, that's a nightmare. That, you know, I can say that, but it's actually a nightmare because you think now that companies are saying, right, well, the office is still there, open Monday to Friday, 9 to 5, come in when you want. How does it know how many, you know, if it's got a canteen, how much food do we put in there? Are you all going to arrive on a Tuesday?
Okay.
Or are you all going to come in on Wednesday? Or is anyone going to be here on Friday? And so there's some challenges to work out, but at the heart of it, it's about talking to employees about the work they do and how they want to work that's going to drive better decisions on it all.
So is that how you work out the challenges?
Mm.
Basically by having an open communication with the employees?
Yeah.
Because I know, again, other workplaces did that. This, the A team, not the reference to the 80s series, A team will come on Tuesday.
B
team will come on
Wednesday.
Yeah.
So some people have done what they call team anchor days. So they'll say, exactly right. Marketing, Tuesday's your day. So if you're going to all get together, you all do it on Tuesday and everyone knows that you're going to be in on the Tuesday. So there's a communication thing as well. Because a lot of people have said, I wanted to go to the office, I got there and there was no one there, so I'm not going to go back. So there's a lot of stuff we haven't worked out yet. But I think the organizations that have got the best chance of succeeding in this are the ones that are kind of breaking the mold completely. So the first one that really came out after all of this was a company called Shopify, which I'd never heard of Shopify, right? But Canadian online retailer. And they said, we are getting rid of our offices. We are digital by default, right? Now, for me, that feels like too much one way, right?
Okay.
But if it works for them, if it works for their business, if it works for their people, then so be it. But shortly after that, Spotify came out with their work from anywhere policy. Now, what's interesting about their work from anywhere policy is they said, work wherever you feel comfortable or want to work. What, you know, you're in charge. We're going to build this around you
and
as an
employee. And the fine print that has Wi-Fi.
Well, true, right. So you can go and work in one of Spotify's offices, right?
Okay.
So any office, anywhere in the world, it doesn't matter what team you're in or whatever it is, you can work in a Spotify building. Here they are. There's 10, I don't know how many there is, but let's say there's 10 around the world. These are where they're located. Or you can work from home, and that's fine. You can work anywhere you want, and you can log in, and you know, we might have to get you into certain locations at certain times, but we'll work that out and all the rest of it. And we'll, I should imagine they pay for that travel and all the rest of it. And then they recognize that there might be people in between that don't live near one of the Spotify locations, but also for whatever reason, and it might be the amount of space they have, it might be that they've got 100 kids, whatever it might be, they don't want to work at home. So what they've said is, you can find somewhere local, that like a co-working space. Now everyone will think about WeWork and stuff, but there's lots of independents that you know, based in, you know, what is one that introduced my us to, right? Yeah. Right, my workspace.
Yeah,
right?
That's how we know each other, from a co-working space. Yeah.
So, but what Spotify say is, if you find one of those and you want to work there, we'll pay for it.
Okay, so that is completely breaking the mold.
Yeah.
Very much listening to your employees.
Yeah.
And I guess being driven by results. Like, as long as your KPIs are met, you're fine to do anything.
But that's the hardest thing. That's the thing that's actually held this back before the pandemic and is still a bit of a challenge, is things like, you think about employment contracts, right? People start a new job. Anyone listening to this that's works in a kind of, what, you know, I guess what we call a knowledge worker professional environment, right, will have an employment contract. And that employment contract typically will tell you, the main unit of measurement about what you're going to give to the company as an individual is time.
Yeah, that's how I have contracts with trainer, right, with coaches here.
Yeah, 36 hours. Now, it might be different. Again, this is where you've got to be business specific. You will need to know how many hours you have available because you're open and you need to provide services within a time frame, right?
Yeah.
But let's say it's a salesperson, right? And let's say that you set them a sales target and they smash it on day one of the week, right? You've got a weekly sales target and you smash it on day one. Is it okay for them not to do any work day two, three, four, five? Now, it would take a very brave company to do that, and it would cause problems because I'm sure other people would wonder why they're not working and we are and all the rest of it. And then you've got to talk about, well, they've hit their targets and all the rest of it. But as a kind of a thinking exercise, are we comfortable with that? Does it matter how much time it takes you to do something, or does it matter what the outputs are? So companies don't, their contracts don't allow you to get into really outcome-based, what they call outcome-based performance. But the other thing is, the way we work has also always been quite fixed, right? You know, contracts will say you're either fixed or remote.
Yeah.
It doesn't say you can be a bit of both if you want. They are starting to now, and the HR professionals, you know, are kind of scratching their heads going, okay, how do we change employment law? And there's lots of stuff still to come out, I think. But I always think back to my first day, my very first day, my very first job, right? I got shown into the office, shown my desk, shown my computer. That's where you work. No one asked me how or why or where.
But this is your...
That's it. And that's where I had to do every task. That's why I had to do every task. Every task at that station. And when I got promoted to be a manager, my station didn't change. But I got four or five totally new tasks because now I've got to manage people. But I'm still in that station.
Interesting. So it wasn't... Yeah, I guess... So who thought about it originally? Why was your station your station? Who thought about that, that's the best idea?
Well, actually, funnily enough, I mean, that's a difficult one to answer generally, right? Because, again, you can draw it right back to ideas like, you know, Ford, you know, in the mm-hmm. Industrial Revolution, right? Where you think about manufacturing plants, where you had your spot on the production line, your role, you know, whether it's putting tires on, that's what Henry Ford kind of revolutionized, right? Which is this idea that we can be more productive, i.e. we can make more cars more quickly with less people if everyone just has their job and just does their bit.
Kind of like what McDonald's did for burgers.
Yes, right.
You see it in Starbucks and...
Yeah, exactly, yeah, so right. So if you then see the evolution of organizations, I have my station, I come in here. Now, the personal computer was a massive, massive change in all of that sort of stuff. Now, the computer would have started as a thing that you had to go to the office to access, right? You could, you know, the internet didn't exist. You couldn't access it anywhere else. But in terms of how modern offices look, there's a guy called Robert Probst, and he was a researcher who worked for Herman Miller in the 60s, right?
Okay.
Now, Herman Miller being the furniture company, that, you know, one of the biggest furniture companies in the world for office furniture. And he wrote a book about what great office design should look like. Right? And he did loads of psychological studies, space studies, all the rest of it.
Okay.
And he said the optimal way to set someone up is with a kind of angled partition so they can have privacy. So we're going to have a partition.
Yeah.
But don't make it a cube. Make it a slightly tapered so that you still get the sense that you're part of something and you're not boxed off. But if you need a little bit of privacy, you can get it. So that was his kind of idea. And I might be, you know, sort of butchering his work here by describing it as that. But what Herman Miller at the time, and they're very progressive thinking now, but at the time, what they saw was, hey, look, this cube idea, we can produce those really cheaply and sell lots of them and make lots of money.
Okay.
Now, in fairness to Robert Props, he literally drew a cube and put a big cross next to it and said, don't do this, right? But that's what they did. And that's kind of where the modern office was kind of born
out. So it's got, okay, there was this cube extended, like a more like a trapezoid.
Yeah, yeah.
The kind of idea.
Yes, exactly that. Yeah, yeah.
And then they thought, actually, we can squeeze in more, I guess.
Yes.
When you have a...
It became an absolute economic decision. We can get more people in there. So it ends up like that scene in The Matrix, you know, when he's like looking over partitions and stuff. And they're soulless, horrible, terrible offices.
So they butchered the idea.
Yeah.
Of, wow. Okay.
But that, in effect, started a... I guess you could trace it back to that. Started a series of trends and fashions that have never really quite cracked, I would say until the last 10 years, quite cracked productive office environments, right? Because what they did is they just lifted the partitions out. And
yeah, but that's,
we're open plan now.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. So it wasn't the next stage. Let's go open plan. And then no one's as effective or efficient or as happy as they could be because, again, they have no pride. Now it's the opposite way. First, you were enclosed. Now you have all this open space.
Well, it goes right back to the hybrid. You know, the negative thing about hybrid, which is one or the other, because in a cube you lose all the collaborative kind of community part. Then you lift the partitions up, and now we've got that bit, but we've got too much of it.
So it's almost like when you talk about when you look at societies, right, and you have the. It's more like you have the sort of Eastern societies where it's very much about the communities, families, big.
Yeah.
Sort of no one can, everyone's in your business, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, the upside is you'll never be alone and the problems will get solved quickly.
Yeah.
The downside, you are never by yourself and you can actually never get to, I mean, not that you never, but for a certain point when you're there, it's very hard to find out what you like, what are, and all those things, how what's best for you.
Yeah.
Whereas you go to the like big sort of US Western, where it's very much individual. It's all about me.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? How rife is depression and loneliness, and like how rife is that? Whereas like if we are all individual, I have time to figure it out. Whereas that's championed, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know. It's just for me, it seems that both extremes are not great.
It's
good to sort of merge and have like a combination of both. That's what sort of, but that's like slightly, I think I went
there is this thing, right? The culture of work as well. So like geographical locations will have a culture of doing work. And the American culture was very, I mean, if you go to Manhattan, I find when I went to Manhattan and dealt with companies there about their office space and stuff, it's totally different to then even the West Coast of America. Completely different. So in Manhattan, for instance, everyone's crammed in, everything's grey, everything's clinical and corporate, right? And part of the reason for that is that Manhattan's office space is one of the most expensive bits of real estate on the planet. Now, you go to San Francisco, or you go, well, actually, where I was in LA for this, I met an architect's practice in LA, and they had this huge barn because there's more space there, and therefore more space means it's cheaper.
Like, it's funny with the culture as well. Like what he said. So I'm from Poland, right? It's very, very direct the way you speak to people. And it's like, it's, you know, sometimes can perceived as rude, I guess. But it's when I try to do, I guess in England, where I originally sort of started to do anything, in being self-employed, developing an app and all those things, like, I was coming out of the meeting and I actually wasn't sure what was the outcome of the meeting because everyone agreed to it. We did few sort of jokes some sarcasm thrown in between, and then yeah, we shook hands, and I actually didn't know, is it a yes, is it a no? I'm like, that is confusing. I found it really confusing.
Yeah, yeah.
Originally, like being initially in England, I was like, I have no idea if it was a good meeting, if I had a deal, or if I don't have a deal. And it's still to this day, I struggle with that sometimes, because I'm like, I just want an answer.
Well, we interviewed a guy called Sam Conniff, right? And he wrote a book called Be More Pirate. And he was sort of, it's kind of like semi-history book about pirates and their pioneering social evolution that they did. You know, they were the first community of people to accept same-sex marriages and things like that, right? So the pirates did a lot of really interesting stuff, and he kind of relates it to modern mm-hmm. practice. And he's doing some more work now around uncertainty and how we could be a bit more comfortable with uncertainty. But when we're talking to him now, I don't know the numbers off the top of my head, but I'm going to give you a kind of idea, right? He said something like, when they did this survey, 85% of people said that they had been in a meeting and verbally agreed with something whilst not agreeing with it in their head. So they heard something, they thought that's a terrible idea, and then they nodded when everyone was asked, is everyone happy with that now?
That's yes. crazy. Oh, obviously, then it goes to like a mass sort of thinking and...
groupthink. Yeah, that's
groupthink.
Exactly.
And that's...
But the killer stat, he told me that, and I was like, I can believe that. 70% of those people said that they then went on to actively sabotage that idea.
Wow. Okay.
Not necessarily in a very clear and obvious way. They didn't go and start unplugging stuff and deleting files, but they just weren't as helpful as they could have been for that project.
How interesting. And I'll tell you how I always found, and I was quite young when I left here, but in Poland, you'd give an offer to someone, they'll be outraged because it's like, that is ridiculous offer. Any offer would be ridiculous. Outrage. They will say they bid.
Yeah.
You do a little sort of defense around it, a little dance. And then you agree, you shake hands, and you know that's the deal.
Done. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So it's very. So whereas here, I think it's like it's just the metaphors. It's just metaphor after metaphor after metaphor, and we leave the meeting and we did few quotes from the movies. You know, we quoted Layer Cake, and I'm like, I still don't know if I'm having this office space or not. And it's like it's remarkable, and I'm I'm so it's just. But that's I can actually believe it the sabotaging the own idea that you agreed to. Yeah.
And I think, I mean, obviously, I'd love to know what that number then looks like in a Teams call or a Zoom call, because you can get away with it much better, I think, you know, just agreeing with it, turn your camera off and make all the faces you want about stuff. But I want to come back to, you know, that idea that you said about the extremes, right? And why they're difficult. So we've kind of lurched, this history of the office is kind of lurched from one extreme to the other. Now, both of them, both the cubicle and open plan, bad open plan, have been driven by cost, right? It's cheaper. If you get rid of all the walls in your office, you get more people in. Now, some of the most progressive thinkers, there's a guy called Frank Duffy, who's kind of considered the godfather of workplaces. He was an architect, but he understood that the design of the building was one thing. Actually, how it lived and breathed and how people used it and how it evolved was actually more important than the original design. But I was reading one of his papers, and he talked about this German idea called Bürolandschaft, which is basically office landscape. And the idea being, and I think gyms are really good. I know you were sort of just moaning about metaphors, but I'm going to use one. If we use the gym as a metaphor, right, you've got different stations for different types of exercise. Now, some of them you can do maybe one or two different things, but you wouldn't ask someone to go and run on the rowing machine, right? But in offices, right, in offices, we ask everyone to do the same thing at the same place.
Like you had to do when you might give them a meeting room as well.
Exactly. So you might give them a meeting room as well. But that's it. It's like you, if you're not doing it in the meeting room, then you're doing it at your desk and vice versa. Now, what this sort of office landscape idea is about, and it then may become like late 70s, early 80s, this idea of activity-based working, which was an architectural idea that said you go to the right place, the right space to do the task that you're doing at the time. Now, the most simple example, I guess, in offices is like a library area if you need to go and read a paper. So you go and sit in the library. Now, I talk to organizations who put a library in, and this is where the idea of workplace experience cannot just be about the physical space. It has to be about technology, and it has to be about culture, right? They put the library in, so that's where people are going to go and read reports and proofread stuff and all the rest of it. No one used it. And the reason no one used it is that the senior management still had private offices, and therefore didn't need to go to the library to concentrate. And because no one else saw senior management in there, they were like, well, maybe we're not allowed to use it. I don't want them thinking I'm flicking through Facebook or Twitter or whatever, you know? So culturally, you've got to see the space and use it and help people understand how to use it. But you then start designing all these different types of space, and that gets you away from this idea of rows and rows and rows of desks and says, well, actually, we've got place. If you need to do some emails, that's the best place to do that. If you need to think, that's the best place to do that. If you need to go and unwind, go there. And you design these landscapes rather than just big blocks of office.
So does it go, the architecture and the design, does it go in line with the values of the company? Like if company values that there has to be some period where you spend by yourself thinking about the idea, and they create those rooms and they actually use that.
Yeah.
That company will actually have a different landscape and use of this, or maybe the same landscape than if there will be another company.
Yeah.
Like when you know, hear of Patagonia creating a child's playground so parents can bring their kids so they can play, they are looked after by a sort of child's nurse whilst you do your work, if you have to be in the office. So I guess it stems with values and clarity of what is required to finish certain tasks. So I guess it stems all the way back to the top, all the way down to the bottom and back up and down. It's like a living thing, I guess, living organism.
Yeah, I think it was Kirsty Groves. We interviewed her in our second episode. I'm sure it was her. She quoted someone else that said, your office space is like the body language of the organization, right? So your organization might say what they are, but when you go to their office space, you kind of, you know, if someone says, I'm really happy, and you're looking at them going, well, you don't look happy. My brain's picking up lots of subconscious signals here. So I kind of like that idea that it's the body language of the organization, but you're right. And in fairness to them, architects are really good at that. You know, they'll go in and say, look, what sort of work do you do here? What sort of tasks have we got to support? And how many people are doing it? If you're an organization that is 90% salespeople, right, then you're going to create an environment that suits sales, right? And it might have a little bit of a nod to some other tasks. But if it's a bit more balanced, you've got to try and get that reflected in the space. And then what you do is you find a kind of your brand and your values and stuff become a manifestation on there. But the reality is, and this is the trick that most organizations miss, is that if you think about workplace experience, and that's what everyone's talking about now, it becomes workplace experience. So again, let's draw it into the gym example. It's not good enough for your gym to have good equipment, right?
No, equipment's nothing, actually. Right. I would argue, because a lot of gyms advertise themselves purely on features. Yeah. That's the equipment. You have this rower, you have a row of rowers, a row of treadmills, go and sign up. Whereas if you don't have someone who looks after you in that building, right, who makes you use it and look forward to using it, it's meaningless.
Yeah.
Sorry.
But that's an experience then. You know, coming in, knowing who's at the desk, getting a coffee, having a joke, going up there, seeing this. Additional things, events, you know, this podcast and asking them to contribute to it. It's all part of a package of experiences. Now, what organizations have really switched on to, they were already going in this direction, but the pandemic really heightened it, because what the pandemic did is say, and there's this sort of big, what they call the great resignation, and everyone's sort of talking about, oh, I mean, I did it. I quit my job during the pandemic and went freelance and set up my own business, right? So lots of people did that. They reflected and gone, I want to do things differently. So what you've got is a shift in power to employees. It's now an employees market, right? Any organization you speak to, at some way they will talk about, we're finding it difficult to find people. So then you start saying, okay, people, and I talked to, you know, I spoke to a recruiter and they said the number one question, how often do you want me in the office? Why do you want me in the office? What will I be doing when I'm there? Whereas that used to be like, if you get offered, you go, is there any room for flexibility? You know, flexible working? You go,
whereas now this is
it's now front and center, right? So what organizations are realizing is they need to build an experience. Now, if you only think about workplace as the physical thing, and this is why the hybrid thing was always a bit difficult, if you only think about it as a physical location, you're only looking at one part of the experience. You've got to think about behaviors and people and how you interact, and you've got to think about the tools. So think about the typical day in an office person, someone who works in an office, their kind of routine, right, pre-pandemic, they would get up in the morning, right?
Mm-hmm.
They would get in the shower and they might start thinking about their day. And they'll go, right, what have I got on today? Oh, I've got that meeting, right? Oh, right. Oh, God, the meeting rooms are never ready when we need them. Or, you know, they've got crap coffee up there, so I'm going to have to pick up a coffee on the way or whatever it might be. And you drive into the office and you go through all the traffic and you get to the car park and there's never a car parking space free. So you spend 10 minutes trying to drive around there. Then you walk in and the receptionist is always miserable because she's been there 20 years and she hates her job and she sits there on her own all day. You know, the security guard is sitting there thinking everyone's going to be breaking in and all the rest of it. So looking you up and down and your key card doesn't work. And then you get upstairs and no one knows you're there. And then you can't get into the room and it's not locked or it's not been tied. So all these things all are part of the experience. Now, some of that will be physical stuff and services and all the rest of it. Some of it will be culturally, you know, people don't clear up after themselves and do that. That's got nothing to do with the space. That's everything to do with the people that use it.
Okay.
Or the Wi-Fi never works. Well, that's a technical thing. So what we've started doing both through the software platform, but also what we do with the podcast is look at it through those three big lenses. So spaces, and that could be office spaces, home spaces, third spaces, whatever we want, you know, what they call third spaces, which is basically anything that's not a home or an office. Technical tools, you know, your Wi-Fi, your laptops, your connectivity, and people.
Culture.
Exactly, right? And all of those things will have an impact on businesses. And businesses are starting to switch onto that now. And they go, well, actually, if we can get that blend right, if we can get all these things working together, then we're going to get more talent because we can start talking about it. And they'll, you know, our employees will tell their friends and they'll talk about it on social media and all
so
the rest of it.
So who does that in a business, in a switched on business? Is there a new role or is there like a, or is that coming stemming from HR? Is that stemming from the C-suite? Yeah, is that stemming from... I'm guessing it's not coming from a financial.
Well, so it's interesting. The world I come from, the facilities management world, typically reported into finance, right? And that's where workplaces have become this kind of cost management tool. You know, they've tried to do these working environments as cheaply as possible. And that might surprise some people, particularly if they've been put into a very nice, swish new building.
Mm-hmm.
But organizations will pay for that building with capital expenditure, right? So costs that they can spread across their accounts across a number of years. But their operating expenditure, the year in, year out, is bigger in the sense that obviously it's a continual cost, but it proportionally kind of gets less. And you spend all the money fitting it out, but then you say to the people operating it, which were typically facilities managers, say, you need to operate this now as low cost as you can.
Okay.
So all the services and the experiences start to decline.
Okay, so is it more like from, I guess it's not information no one needs, but it's just interesting that that will probably stem like a new breed of people that work in the office and have that task.
There is. And so I did a bit of work years ago where we talked about chief workplace officer who would have a kind of appreciation for facilities and estates, for technology, IT, and for HR and people. But what I think is starting to happen is that the HR community are becoming more switched on to workplace experience being part of the talent proposition. So we're going to try and attract people in. And I'll never forget, I did a piece of work once where I went to one of the biggest energy firms on the planet, right?
Okay.
So massive, massive organization, eye-wateringly.
Kremlin.
It was not quite, but huge, right? Huge. And I was showing them some data that said their people didn't like their office space, right? And the HR director came in. Well, actually, I think she was the senior VP for Europe or something for HR. She's massive, right? And she was late to the meeting, so she didn't hear the blurb and the intro. And we're going through the data and I'm talking away. And it wasn't good data. It was, you know, people didn't like this office space. It wasn't helping them work. It was getting in the way of stuff.
Okay.
And she said, what data is this? Sorry. She thought I was just giving them some general research. I said, oh, this is your workforce in this building. And she goes, who took the survey? I said, well, everyone. And, you know, we've only got 40% of people that agree that it's a productive environment. And she stopped the meeting and turned to the team and said, that's not good enough. We're spending millions and millions of dollars recruiting the very best people in the world. And then we're putting them in environments where they can't do good work.
Wow, that's actually remarkable.
Yeah.
I thought you were going to tell me some horror story that she
But it changed everything.
Wow.
That team that was never getting budget suddenly started getting budget. Because can you imagine... can you imagine like any other industry that would, like, I always related it to football, right? You know, imagine, right, I'm going to use Tottenham because I'm a Tottenham fan, right? I don't want to offend any other clubs, right? Imagine Tottenham going out and buying spending the world record fee on a striker, but then getting them in and saying, "Oh yeah, you train at the local park." You wouldn't do it because you spend so much money on the talent.
That makes great sense. Wow, that's. But I love her reaction.
Yeah.
So I'm keeping you a bit long here. Mm. What's the, you know, because we obviously mentioned that it's a very much about sort of well-being of employee and that increases productivity of an employee and the culture and the team. So if you are working from home, and I know you don't have to down other workplaces, there is a co-working space.
There are cafes,
as you said, there are different options. If you do work from home, what would be the best setup of a home work? Does it have to be a shed in the bottom of your garden? Do you have to spend 20K on it?
No, you don't have to. I mean, it depends. So much of this depends on what you have available in your house, right?
So let's say that you have a small unused bedroom that is the clutter, or you have a corner, you have a part of the room.
I'll talk from my own personal experience, right? I have a small spare bedroom that I've, you know, that's got enough PowerPoints. It's got a nice big window because that's really important. Windows that I can open, which a lot of offices don't have.
Okay.
That's what I'd be looking at. Now, if you can't get that, I mean, I wouldn't spend £20,000 on a cabinet at the bottom of the garden unless you had £20,000 spare. I mean, they're good, don't get me wrong, I'm not knocking them, but I don't think you need to be that extreme. You know, if you think about where I am in the co-working space, it's £150 a month for 10 days a month, right?
You are pitching for them as well. Jesus.
Hey, look, they're a good bunch. But you see what? It's not massive money, right? And I would be, if I worked for an organisation, I'd be telling them to pay it because it's not that much money. You know, in West London, in an office space, it costs an organisation on average, it's gone up slightly, about £12,000 a year to put one person in their building.
What?
When you look at that, it's crazy. When you look at the rental space, the services, the furniture, all that stuff is about 12 grand a year.
So it's bargain for them if you go and work in a co-working space down the road in my workspot UK.
Exactly. it's 2 grand a year. So what I'd be saying to people is be realistic about it, because if you're on a dining room table or breakfast bar or working off your sofa, that's not going to be good for anybody. And all the research that was done during the pandemic about who's doing well working at home and who isn't. I mean, you talked about it generally. There was this real curve of typically younger people living at home with their parents, working off their bed or their sofa, and they were suffering. You know, they weren't able to work productively. Their mental health was getting a real knocking. They were desperate to get back into the office. Not all of them. It wasn't general, but that was kind of the average picture. The people that were doing really well were people like me that had a spare room, good services.
A bit older, no offense.
Well, exactly. More established in your career, more senior, so you didn't need to feel the need to be there. You had a bit more knowledge about your work because you've got a bit more experience. Yeah. Good Wi-Fi and all this sort of stuff. And then there was a lot of people in the middle that were trying to make things work. Now, if you are able to get a space where you can shut a door, I think that's really crucial. Somewhere where you can shut a door.
Shut the door, open the window.
Yeah, exactly, right? Leave the door open if you don't mind people walking by and saying hello and all the rest of it. And that's the problem with going back to going back to office environments, a lot of people are put in an open plan environment. They haven't got the ability to shut people off. They haven't got the ability to focus. So I would say that. Now, the other thing I'd start looking at is get a proper chair. Like, it's amazing the impact that a chair can have, because you sit down an awful lot. But that also leads to the next point, which is find something where you can sit and stand, right? Because there is so much data now about how sitting all day is really, really, really dangerous. There's a guy called Gavin Bradley who's so passionate about it. If you look at Get Britain Standing, he's got loads of data. One of the biggest data points I found, I mean, sitting down all day, you'll know this from a fitness point of view, right? The stuff that increases, the morbidity that increases, but generally there's a 50% increased chance of you dying by any cause if you sit down too much.
Yes, however, I would be very careful with this, you know, with looking through that one lens, because it's usually when you look at people who, let's say, eat less vegetables, right? Mm. And you also look at the morbidity.
Other causes,
and it's
right,
like, these people are usually more likely to move less in general, smoke more, take recreational drugs, suffer from depression.
Correct.
It's not a cause and effect. So from fitness point of view, I would say standing itself isn't better than sitting.
No.
Being immobile is the issue, right?
And that's
so when
it.
People get the standing desk and they do exactly the same thing, just in a different position, it's like you're going to end up in the same issues.
Yeah, so you've got to do, you're right, all the data says it's a transition, more transitions. But your point about, yes, you're right, there's other characteristics about people that sit down all day that are as bad, if not worse, for you. But I would guarantee if we did a study, you should do a study with your people that come in here, right? Fit people or people getting fitter or really fit and want to get even fitter, right? How many hours a day do you sit down at work?
So it's quite interesting because we do, we recommend tracking your calories, right?
Yeah,
tracking your intake of food. And we have a nutrition course written for it. And you can sign up for a 28-day challenge, by the way. So I'll do my own plugin. And in our nutrition course, when I teach people how to calculate the calories, and it says there is a point where you calculate your TDEE. You go, how old are you? How much do you weigh? What's your height? And then what's your activity? And I say, when you have options, even if you come to the gym 4 times a week, if you walk, if you do on average, check your average step count. You know, we have all sorts of devices now. If it's less than 5,000 a day, you put sedentary. Because it doesn't matter that you come here for 45 minutes, you should sit on your ass for the rest of the day.
Yeah.
So you look at that sort of NEAT, which is the non-exercise specific active thermogenesis. How much you, like, how active are you in a general day?
Yeah.
Gym almost doesn't matter if that's all you do and then you sit on your ass. So I said, it doesn't matter. Look at your average step count. Look how active you are throughout the day. Yeah. And that's what really matters, the general activity.
So in a work context, then, there's ways that you can get around that, right? Now, I've got a sit-stand desk, so it's adjustable. So sometimes I can stand up. So if I'm doing calls, if I'm recording the podcast, I sometimes forget because I can't be bothered. But I'll put the desk up and I'll stand. And also what Gavin Bradley taught me as well was move whilst you're doing it, stretch and all the rest of it. But equally, why can't you go for a walk and do that Teams meeting? Why can't you go for a walk,
Put
your headphones in and listen to people and contribute? Why can't you go for a walk?
That's one of the sort of things we ask people here. Like, that's your step count. Could you go for a walk? Or could you... So it's interesting. People have those bottles that tells them at 12 p.m. have a sip, at 2 p.m. have a sip. Yeah, the one that you have.
Yeah.
Because they will say, otherwise I won't have a sip, right? Yeah. But I always almost like you gamify it, right? So the first challenge is you drink more water.
Yeah.
The second challenge, I know you drink more water now, right? Yeah. I don't need to remind you about water anymore. We are past that stage.
Yeah.
So why are we at the stage? So you bring that bottle, you put it in the kitchen. So every time you want to drink, you want to have a sip of water, you stand up, go and have a sip, come back.
Yeah.
Because I know you're going to drink it now. But now that allows you to do more activity throughout.
Yeah.
More activity that you don't know of.
So to kind of extend that then, right? Because what we've talked about in terms of, okay, I'm working from home now, how can I do this better? Is that we've been mindful about the space. Like, where is it? Is it good? Can I concentrate? Can I, open a window? Can I get enough light? All those sort of physical bits.
Close the door, open the window, plug in.
Exactly, right? Can I get good Wi-Fi, right? Then we've talked about your activities, so really thinking about physical activities and behaviors and how you do stuff. And there's also a tech bit, which kind of blends with the behaviors, right? Which is, there was this really interesting conversation I had. I forget who it was in the end up, but someone was saying to me that all these studies said about, working from home, do you feel that you've been more productive? And a lot of people said, yeah, I feel really productive and the rest of it. But they also showed data that people are working longer hours. Right.
Okay.
So they would say, I'll switch on at 8 and, because I'm at home. What people tend to do is people would call it donate their commute. So if you got on the train at 7 o'clock every morning to get into the office for 9 and then suddenly you're working from home, you don't start at 9 o'clock. You'll go, well, I'll start at 8 because, I've got nothing else to do or whatever. Right. So you might start at 8. Now, definitely people have started rearranging their day so they can start and then maybe go into the school run and then come back and pick it up and all the rest of it.
Okay.
So there's a bit of that going on. But productivity, technically, is inputs over outputs or outputs over inputs, right? Basically, how much do I need to put in to get a certain amount out?
No, output over input.
Yeah, there we go. Right, you got it right way around. I'm supposed to be the expert on this. Don't embarrass me. But what this person said was that the outputs didn't increase. People just felt like they were able to do it better. But if you're working longer hours, but the outputs are the same, you're less productive. Because you're putting more in to get the same amount
absolutely.
Out.
Absolutely.
So you've got to be very careful. Now, that gets you into starting to think about how you work, and particularly in a digital way, right? So distractions. And it's better at home for physical distractions. You're not getting, I mean, I'd still get distracted. I've got 2-year-old twins, so I still get distractions at home, right? But in the office, it's terrible. You know, that kind of idea, you're sitting there concentrating on something, or a really important letter you're writing, or a report, whatever it might be, and someone says, have you got 5 minutes? And you say no, and they talk anyway. And you're like, I was in the middle of something there, you know? And there was a study that said that people get disturbed in an office every 11 minutes there's an interruption, and it takes 23 minutes to get back into
23.
Yeah, to get back
minus
into your
12 from every interruption.
Yes. Yeah. And then of course you're never going to make it up, because in 11 minutes time someone's going to start the clock again. So homeworking has definitely helped with that physical bit, but digital distraction has probably gotten worse, right? So Teams notifications, emails coming in, or, you know, your phone buzzing, all that sort of stuff.
Is it the same 23 minutes to get back?
I don't know. I should find more academic studies and interview them. But it will be, right? It will be.
Because it's the same distraction. It's like, a distraction. It's like saying, okay.
Come out of flow. Now, so when we were talking about this before the podcast, you mentioned Cal Newport, who's written lots of books around digital.
Deep work.
Yeah, deep work, digital detoxing, all this sort of stuff. Really interesting stuff. And there's another guy called Bruce Daisley who's written a book called The Joy of Work, and he touches on this sort of stuff. But there's some ideas, really simple ideas, that says if you just think about the digital work that you're doing differently, then it can really open up these areas of focus. Now, Microsoft, and I'm not plugging them by any means, they don't need me to plug them, they're doing quite well, I understand. You know, they
vaccines.
Yeah, well, that's true. Yeah, it's a bit of a sideline. But they do their thing through, I forget what the app's called now, but you get that sort of daily email that says, right, we've looked at your diary and you've got a couple of blocks here for focus work. Do you want me to put them in for you? Right. So there's little tools appearing that can help with that. But what I used to do when I worked in an office environment and I had a big team is I would wake up in the morning, get myself sorted, get into work, right? Turn Outlook on, let my emails come in, and then I would work offline. I'd straight away turn it offline, because the morning's post has arrived, right? And I would reply to the emails that needed replying to. And I would spend the first half hour, again, Gavin Bradley, the sit-stand guy, says to me, stand up when you write emails because you do them twice as quick. And then right enough, he does. Like, you fly through emails if you stand up when you do them.
I do that, standing.
Right. So off they go. But when you hit send, because you're offline, they don't go anywhere. Because the worst thing that happens when you send an email is you get 3 back. So they're now ready. They're in the mail room, ready to go out this afternoon, okay? And then I'll look at my tasks. Right, I need to read that report. I need to write this. I need to think about that. I'll then do that with my phone on Do Not Disturb, with my email shut, not minimized, not silenced, with little notifications coming in my right-hand corner, off. They're not here anymore. And I'll sit there and do that work. And then at lunchtime, I might go, right, I'm going to turn my emails
back on. You go online and then they actually send.
They send, and then a new batch will come in. I'll look at them and go, right. Now, that's just how I did it, right? But there's nothing, I've always felt really passionate about this. There's nothing that ever tells you how to do good work. We all come out of school, out of college, out of university, whatever it might be. And, you know, and I'm talking principally here in office environments, and you're thrown into an office and you're pointed to a desk and you're just told to crack on. And no one sits there and goes, actually, be really mindful about your work. Be really, really purposeful about how you do it, when you do it, why you want to do it, where you're going to go and do it.
I feel this is going to like part two already. So I will have to like divide the two parts. But no, you're right. No one tells you. No one tells you anything about it. And the interesting bit, I guess, what he's saying is that you basically treat, you have a bunch of work, you get it finished, you get another batch back.
Yeah,
because
yeah.
It's quite interesting. And obviously, I always think of my sort of own example. And Jim, you know, it's a different sort of kettle of fish.
Mm.
But and especially as you are self-employed, you know, your own sort of person, and you actually started something out of experiment of your own, in your own name.
Yeah.
In a model that is completely experimental. I was very protective, you know, micromanaging almost. Mm. But then I realized, actually, you know, unless someone, you know, touch wood, unless someone dies here, I don't actually have to do, like, nothing will be urgent. No one will leave because of one event.
Yep.
You know, it's always death by 1,000 cuts to a small business. I haven't delivered many times over some crucial bit for someone.
Yeah.
Even with injuries, right? You call the ambulance. Someone has a heart attack, you call an ambulance. And these things can happen regardless. Like,
yeah.
Speaking of injuries, most injuries happen not because you lifted something in the wrong way. Most injuries happen because you lifted that whilst you were stressed, underslept, and all that stuff. So all the other things outside of the gym are the cause of,
of the injury.
Of the injury, really. But nothing ever happens that is so sudden that I have to be here.
Yeah.
So like I started working on Wednesdays from home because I'm like, all the coaches are here. Why do I need to be here?
Exactly.
And this week, as an experiment, I didn't go to work for 2 days because everyone was here. Like when I looked at my rota, everything was covered. And I thought everything that needs to be replied to, I'll reply when I'm back on Thursday.
Yeah.
And wow, that was liberating because that is the realization that you don't have to reply to every message instantly. It almost takes that like a veil of anxiety off your shoulders.
Yeah. So, well, I mean, what you're talking about there is this, what they call the always on culture, right? Now, I remember when I was, it's got to go back about 10, 15 years, whatever. And I was just sort of moving into sort of middle management and heading up towards senior management in what was quite a small company. It wasn't a big company. And I remember everyone getting BlackBerry phones and me thinking, I know I've made it when they give me the BlackBerry phone, right? And I mean, that's an interesting thing about culture, because a lot of cultural experts will talk about the fact that we're social animals and we like seeing successful people. What do they look like? What are they doing? I need to replicate that. So I'm going to replicate that. So the BlackBerry phone, getting given the phone, was a kind of a sign that you're part of the club.
I made it.
You've made it.
I'm successful.
What that actually meant was we can send you emails any time of day now. It's not just now when you're in the office.
But it's sold under that icon of you made it. Like the success is sold. The being overstressed, tired, anxious, and online to do some horrible addictions is sold as like, this is the icon of you made it.
So I was speaking to someone from the Health and Safety Executive, the government body that looks after kind of work health and safety. And they did an experiment where they said, we're going to send an email sort of mid to late evening. So after 5, but not at the end of the night. And we're going to see what happens. I think it was might have been an all staff meeting or an email, or maybe just a sort of a closed group.
Mm.
And people were pinging back emails until 3 o'clock in the morning.
That's mad. That's crazy.
And so this fellow went and grabbed this, you know, found this guy that had done the very last email at something like 10 to 3 or something like that. And he said, why did you do that? What on earth did you do that? And he said, well, actually, I looked at my phone. I was in a nightclub. And because I've got my emails on my phone, I looked at them because that's a whole other podcast about, you know, how apps, you know, get into your head and get you addicted to checking them. And he said, I'd seen that my boss was the last person to reply. So I felt the need. I needed to reply as well. So we've got this always on culture. But to your point about, you know, what I got to thinking about when you were talking about injuries and tiredness and all the rest of it is that there's actually this diminishing return on work, right? In the UK, I think I'm right in saying we've got amongst Europe, we've got the sort of highest average weekly work hours. Right?
Okay.
But we all know, because we're watching the news at the minute, that our performance, our economic performance isn't matching other countries. So that
there's I think we are ahead of Russia.
I saw that in the news.
And that's without sanctions.
The only G20 that we're ahead of is Russia. Yeah. I was like, oh, God. There is, and the Dutch are amongst the lowest average work hours in a week. but their GDP is flying, you know. I mean, I don't know what it's doing now. I don't keep on touch of it. But this study I was looking at, right? So that there is not a correlation between the length of time that you work
Absolutely, and the
amount of quality work that you do and productivity. Now, what that gets to is that a lot of people in knowledge worker environments make decisions. That's what knowledge work is about. We get presented with problems. We come up with creative solutions. We've got to make decisions. But there's now science that shows that there is a point where you get, you make crap decisions because you're tired. Now, the study that always gets pushed out on this thing is about an Israeli parole officer, right? They did this study where they looked at Israel parole hearings in Israel. And what they found, I don't know why they chose Israel, but what they found, I guess it was an Israeli university, but what they found was that you're more likely to get
parole. I guess you answer your own question.
Yeah, it makes sense really, doesn't it? I guess, so what they found is that you are more likely to get parole in the morning. First, you know, if you're amongst the first hearings.
I saw that was Daniel Kahneman, Thinking Fast, Thinking Slow book.
Right. And when then and then the after study. Lunchtime, right?
Yeah, he's an Israeli. Yeah.
So, and what that's about is I feel fresher and therefore I've got I've got more energy to change something, whereas it's easier when I'm tired just to say
that. Was shocking. It was put them back in. Yeah, on that study, I remember there was something like there's an 80% chance of conviction if your hearing is on a Monday before lunchtime.
Yeah.
And there's 60% of chance to be bailed if it's straight after lunchtime.
Yeah. Well, I'm refreshed and energized.
They took it. He did a follow-up study on that, where he did it because they released a new book after Thinking Fast, Thinking Slow. Only last year I read that book. Forgot the name now. Noise, I think. Noise, the book is. And they did it when your local football team lost on a Sunday. Monday was the Monday before lunchtime. Do not ever, if you are ever about to get sentenced for something, avoid Monday lunch before lunchtime if you can.
Ask what the results were at the weekend. But the point here and relating
sorry,
it to
I
work,
just saw it
no, no, but it's all relevant, right? Because we then think about the always on culture, and we've got the things, and you know, particularly business owners, right? And you know, I'm just taking my first few steps into that world. It's kind of like the pressures, you know, you're so keen for this thing to work and you want to put in, but it gets to a point where more work is not going to be worth it.
You're not
going to do good work. Now, what that's launched is the 4-day week movement. And there's more and more organizations that are saying, we are going to 4 days a week work. And all of them are reporting higher productivity, higher engagement, happier employees.
Just to play devil's advocate, do you think it's just a novelty at the moment? That's why it's a higher productivity. It's like you go on a new diet. You sign up to the gym, right?
Yeah, you go on a new diet.
You feel fresh. Like, doesn't matter. Let's say you go on like Beyonce's strange juice thing. And all you do is drink lemon water with cayenne pepper. Like the silliest, dumbest thing you can do. Right? With maple syrup. And you feel amazing. Like you feel you'll be singing like Beyonce by the end of the week. You go to like halfway day two. When the stress hits, you think, so this, I'm having a burger. Do you feel it's genuine, we are maybe better at 4 day weeks? Or do you feel this is almost a novelty stimuli? Like this is a initial enthusiasm of the pendulum swung the other way. It goes somewhere in the middle.
I think if we take, you know, what we were talking about a moment ago with the average work hours in a week and GDP. So there's some evidence there that actually less might be more. There's one guy that I know who's just been voted the number one, I think it's number one HR influencer in the UK, a bloke called Perry Timms. And his consultancy agency, it's a 4 day a week company. It has been for ages.
That's amazing. That would be interesting to see, right?
Yeah. And what he said, I mean, this is the thing. I think, again, like this is when we get big, blunt kind of ideas and drop them into something that's actually a bit more nuanced, right? But there's this kind of blunt idea that, you know, everyone, like we'll work Monday to Thursday and everyone could be off on Friday. Of course, that's not going to work. So what they do is different people will have different days as their fifth day. So some people might not work Tuesday. Some people might not work Thursdays. But there's also, and I don't know if there's a study for this, but this is more anecdote, right? We all know that the most productive we are, the most work we get done is probably in the 2 days, or if not the week before we go on holiday or we break up for Christmas or the rest of it. Because we're like, no, we kind of have this awareness that time is kind of rattling towards us, right?
Yes.
And then it kind of fires up. And I, you know, talking to Perry, I'm sure I might be misrepresenting what he said, but he was sort of saying to me that actually, because you know that you've got slightly less physical time to do these things, it's more concentrated.
Yeah, it's probably more focused. And like, I'm, you know, anecdotally, N1, I have a dog now. I have a dog in my office. This dog needs walking. So it's a spaniel. I need to walk this dog for an hour a day, non-negotiable. And I'm here.
Yeah.
And obviously, some days I cannot walk him.
Yeah.
So my sister who works with me, she has to help me out.
Mm.
But most of the days, I have to structure my day that whatever happens, 8 a.m. or 9 a.m., I don't see anyone because I'm spending my time with the dog. So I know I have an hour less.
Yeah.
And I will work way better. I'm much more productive since I have the dog.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is ironic. I'm much happier when I have the dog in my office. Yeah, like, yeah. I would never change it for anything. Having a dog in your office when you have a crap session or something, you can just, like, he's the best. He's like a therapy dog. And obviously now when I employ people, they need to be okay with dogs, which is quite interesting. I never thought I would get to that stage. But another example, all of my coaches, everyone that works here has I used to be like, you know, fitness is split shifts because people want to train in the morning, lunchtime and evening, right? Like fitness is brutal as an industry.
Yeah, yeah.
Like everyone is a personal trainer.
Yeah.
Kind of like everyone I ever met, like, or they done some personal training qualifications back in the day.
Yeah.
But statistically, after 6 months, 80% of people leave and never go back because it's savage. It's brutal, sort of 100-hour weeks to sign up first client kind of thing. And everyone tells you no, and you don't know anything after your courses. So you have to be really sort of, you have to develop quite thick skin and, you know, grind through that.
Yeah.
And I came from that mentality. You know, I'm a hard worker. So when I set this up, it was just 100-hour weeks. And that, you know, that broke me badly. Like, and then the pandemic happened, saved me amazingly. Because you would think, what actually didn't work, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So you get rid of everyone that sort of, it just wasn't working really. All the toxicity is out. And like, let's rebuild from scratch. So then I designed that everyone works only mornings or only evenings and they switch every 2 weeks, right? Yeah. We tried it and, you know, then you get feedback and people are like, no, it doesn't work for me.
Yeah.
So now we have, okay, because you still have to be really realistic about sort of the fitness industry, morning, evening.
Yeah.
Okay, so what we come up with, everyone does one split shift.
Yeah.
But they have a day off in the middle of the week.
Yeah.
Right? And they work every third weekend.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, half of Saturday anyway. I was always adamant we close half Saturday and whole Sunday because everyone needs health and they're being away from the gym.
Yeah, yeah.
They need psychosocial health, seeing friends, going out, going on a bike ride. That includes members, that includes staff, that includes myself.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, we are fooling ourselves as people, right? It's like we live in a world that isn't designed to be sort of the world that it is. So we need to set traps for our own selves, you know, not to fall into them. Yeah. And what I noticed, everyone has a day off. So I don't see some of the, because I wasn't here for 2 days and it's only a team of 5 people, but I won't see 2 of my guys. I saw them on Monday. I will see them on Friday.
Yeah.
And everyone is so much fresher because they have either 2 days or 1 day off in the middle of the week.
Yeah, yeah.
So they are able to completely not be here and just come back and like is a new place. Even though you are constantly, you know, fitness is, gyms are very, if you go to a gym and say you don't want to be here for 6 a.m., everyone knows you're not going to ever have a client. If you are a self-employed personal trainer.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it's, so it's, you know what? I actually agree with you on the, from my perspective on a 4 day week.
Yeah.
That is probably will work better. I just don't know how. I never worked in an office. I work in an office in sales for the gyms.
Yeah, yeah.
But I never.
Yeah, I mean, that's
so
one
maybe
thing.
It's not a novelty thing.
Yeah, but it is really. I mean, it's becoming a bit more.
As in,
recognized.
It's not as fad. It's probably will. Is here to stay.
Yeah, I think so. Yes, exactly. And I think what Perry, and I've mentioned his company a couple of times, but what I think they do incredibly well is they communicate it really clearly with people. So I'll drop him an email, and if it's on a day that he's not working, he'll say, we operate a 4-day work cycle here.
Okay, so you know the expectations are set.
Okay, cool, he's off, he'll be back tomorrow, cool. And because there was a lot of talk, I think Sweden did it, and Sweden did it at a national level, and there was a lot of talk about, shall we do it here, and all, you know, all that sort of stuff. And I remember at the time thinking, well, and this is where I kind of got my thinking was quite closed, because I was like, well, what if, you know, organization A needs something from organization B and they're all off? And it's not that. It's not saying that organizations are going to be 4-day a week. It's that work style is 4-day a week. The organizations are open 5 days.
Yeah. So the smooth, the line is someone just takes, someone like a relay race.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right? It's a much smoother relay race rather than everyone runs to the same marathon.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I guess it forces people for a clearer communication, because if I'm not going to be here tomorrow and you coming in my place, I better make sure I communicate very clearly so you can nicely pick it up.
Yeah, yeah.
And it allows more styles to blend, allows communication and openness. I love that.
Yeah.
So, I think on that note, Chris, we can finish. That was very, I will definitely make 2 episodes out of that.
Oh,
I'll press the stop button. Is there anything else you would like to add?
Not really. Not really.